Welcome to the Executive Function Podcast, where we make the invisible keys to success easy for you to teach your child. We'll go beyond theory to proven action, helping you create peace and independence at home and at school with your host, educational author, award-winning teacher, and celebrated learning coach, Sarah Kesty.
Hey everyone, today on our podcast, we have someone with a breadth of experience working as a developmental pediatrician, and he's got some really cool insight about ADHD medication. And where Walt and I, Dr. Walt Karninsky and I, have talked a little bit about before the show about, you know, medication's a little bit tricky. It comes with some emotions. It's a big, big process. So if you are a listener who's like, oh, that this episode isn't for me, hold tight. There's things to learn in every experience when you choose to approach it that way. And Walt, you have learned a lot along the way. Do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners, just kind of your background?
Sure. I'd love to. And first, Sarah, thank you for inviting me to be on the podcast with you. I think you're doing an incredible service for kids when you're working with executive function, because it really is the essence of the problems that occur with ADHD. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. I've been in developmental pediatrics since 1980, so about 42 years now. Over that period of time, I've seen probably 10,000 children, probably 5,000 with ADHD, and the other group were children with autism, cerebral palsy, and other developmental issues. Over that time, I've seen some patterns in the way children respond to ADHD, and I have shared that in the book. And the book is entitled ADHD Medication: Does It Work and Is It Safe? And I think that addresses the two most frequently voiced concerns that parents have about medication. Do they really work? Are they necessary? And if so, are they safe to use?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think you and I have both witnessed the tremendous impact that meds can have for kids. And we're also both coming from this perspective that medications are really personal decisions. So today, I know we're talking a little bit about the parent journey about medication. And when we were brainstorming about what would be of most use for listeners, you shared that you've got some pretty powerful stories that may resonate with parents who are sort of on the medication journey. So it's something new on the podcast, but we talked about, you know, you might read to the listeners from the book as an opportunity to have the thought experimentation in their brain of, does this sound like my story? And if so, how can I take what I'm hearing and really think about it in preparation for the school year and in service of giving my kid's brain the neurochemical support that it might need? Right. So will you read to us, Walt?
I'd love to. And I've chosen three different stories. Each there is only a couple minutes long, but they address the question of concerns and worries that parents have before they start medication, and sometimes after medication as well. Concerns that are often generated by friends or neighbors or relatives who have experienced the same process as well. So let me start with a story about Danny. This is a fictional story that I wrote, but it is not fictitious. And what I mean by that is that it is based upon the stories that I've heard from many parents and from many children themselves. So this is an amalgamation of the true stories that I've experienced over the years. This first one is. So it was 3:20 in the afternoon, and the rain had turned from a light sprinkle to a downpour. Danny would be getting off the bus in a few minutes, so I grabbed an umbrella and picked up a small bag of potato chips and went out the door. As I reached the corner, the bus was pulling up. The door opened and the kids started streaming out. Danny was the last one out. I smiled and waved, but he kept his head down and didn't see me. When he realized how hard it was raining, he jumped down the last step and started to run towards our house. As he turned, he bumped into another boy, but this didn't stop him. He took off running without an apology. "Hey, Danny, over here," I yelled. "Danny!" He turned, saw me, and ran over to get under the umbrella. "Kind of wet," I said. "Huh?" He grinned. "Yeah, I guess so. Well, I brought you some water and potato chips. Here you go." He took them from me, opened the bottle, and began slurping. "Well, what about a thank you?" "Yeah, thanks," he said without much enthusiasm. We arrived at our garage door a few minutes later, and Danny ran in without saying anything. He dropped his jacket and book bag to the floor and ripped open the potato chips. "So, how was your day?" Silence. "Danny?" "What?" "How was your day?" "Fine." "Well, what did you learn today?" "Nothing." "You must have learned something. I can't imagine that Mrs. Miller would just let you sit there all day." "Oh, Mom, stop asking me these stupid questions." He threw the bag of potato chips on the floor, stomped out of the room, went up to his room, slammed the door behind him. I went upstairs and I quietly stood outside his door. I wasn't sure whether I should open the door and confront him for being rude or whether I should just let it pass. Danny had started on Ritalin for his ADHD about a week ago. One in the morning and one at lunch. Mrs. Miller said that the effect was dramatic. Danny was happy, engaged, and learning in school. She said that he was focused in the classroom, always had the correct answer when called upon, and his grades now reflected the intelligence that had been hiding within. She said that he was like a different kid, more confident and at ease. And the other kids had noticed as well. They were beginning to seek him out on the playground. And as a result, he just seemed happier, which was curious because at home, he seemed to be constantly irritable, arguing at the least little thing. Granted, he wasn't running around like before. He wasn't as active as and impulsive, but he was so irritable. Chris even noticed. Chris had noticed as well as it seemed to get worse around 4 or 5 o'clock, right about the time Chris would get home from work. Last night, after Danny had gone to bed, Chris and I had another argument about the medication. "I don't know, Liz. I don't think this medication is working. And Danny just seems mad all the time. I asked him to take out the trash yesterday, and he yelled at me. He's never done that before. He said the trash wasn't his, so he shouldn't have to take it out. I think it's time to stop his medication." I was still outside Danny's door. I knew I couldn't let his rudeness pass, so I turned the doorknob. It was locked. "Danny, could you please open the door?" Nothing. "Danny, please." "Go away," he yelled. "Danny, did something bad happen at school today?" "Go away, get out of here." "Danny, please open the door." I waited about 15 seconds and turned to go downstairs. I heard a click and the door opened slowly. Danny was standing there looking at his wet shoes. "Danny, what's wrong?" Again, he said nothing. He stood there for a while, then rushed toward me. He wrapped his arms around my leg and began sobbing. "Danny, what's wrong? You know I love you. I don't like to see you upset. What happened? What's wrong?" Now, I would contend that there's nothing wrong with Danny. That the Danny that his mother is seeing is dramatically different from the Danny that Mrs. Miller, the teacher, is seeing. So why is there such a difference? And I think it's important to understand what's happening with these medications. Ritalin is an excellent medication for treating ADHD, but it's very short acting. After you take it, it takes effect within a half hour and wears off in about 3.5 hours. That means a dose taken at 7 in the morning would need to be kind of refurbished around noon. So the child would have to run to the school nurse, get his medication, take it, and hopefully that would last till when? About 3:30. When was Danny getting home from school?
About
3:30.
3:30.
Okay. And so what we were seeing was the effect of the medication wearing off, not a direct side effect of the medication. And all that it takes to, in order to do that, is to change him from a short-acting medication to a long-acting medication that wears off more gradually. And his irritability at 3:30 disappeared. So that was,
Interesting.
that's the first example. Let me read you two other stories that deal with what parents call the zombie effect.
I know that's a big concern for a lot of the clients I work with who are creative and work in music or, just other creative fields. Like, what if it turns off that part of my brain? So I'm super
Exactly.
interested to hear that perspective.
Okay, well, now both these stories are true, and they occurred exactly as I've written them here. One day after lunch, I was looking through the list of patients I was scheduled to see at afternoon. I recognized the name of a girl I had seen years ago when she was 12 years old. Michelle had been diagnosed with ADHD, primarily inattentive type, and treated with Ritalin LA. That's the long-acting version of Ritalin. However, after a few visits, she had not returned, and that was 7 years ago. She came into my office without her parents. She said that she thought that she should go back on medication, but her parents didn't want her to, so she came by herself. She said, "I'm an adult now. I can make my own decisions." So I asked what happened before, when she was diagnosed and started on medication, but then didn't return. She paused for a while before she responded, and she said, "Dr. Karnisky, when you put me on that medication, I hated you. I hated the way that medication made me feel. I was able to concentrate better, my grades improved, but I just didn't like the way it made me feel." "So how did you feel?" I asked. "Well, when I was studying, I was more serious. I was able to concentrate better. But when I was with my friends, they told me that when I took the medication, I wasn't as much fun to be around. Before I took medication, we were always laughing and telling jokes. After I took the medication, I was more serious and they didn't want to be around me anymore. So now I'm a freshman at the University of Florida and I know I'm smart, but I'm failing all my classes. I just can't seem to get organized." So after talking to her for a while, I started her back on medication and she returned 3 weeks later. She proudly told me that her grades had improved. "I'm getting A's on all my tests now," she said. "So what do your friends think?" I asked. "That's the weird thing," she answered. "They think I'm a better friend when I'm on my medication. They said that before I started taking medication, I was easily distracted and I wouldn't listen to what they said. They said I interrupted all the time. But when I'm taking my medication, I listen to them and, well, I'm just a better friend." So what happened here? Why did Michelle react differently to medication at 12 and then at 19 years of age? Well, she didn't. She didn't react differently. She reacted the same way to medication at both ages. What changed were her friends. Her 19-year-old friends had different expectations from the friendship she had from her 12-year-old friends. So let me just stop there for a second and point out that what she saw as a side effect, her 19-year-old friends saw as a blessing. And her grades improved and her attitude improved, but her personality did change. And that's what concerns parents. They say it doesn't seem like the same person.
Right.
So let me read one more story that addresses that directly. David was another patient of mine, a bright, hyperactive, impulsive 8-year-old child with ADHD. And according to his teacher, he had a very positive response to stimulant medication. But his mother saw things differently. When I saw him back in my office 2 weeks after starting on medication, his mother was perplexed. "I think he's depressed," she said. When I asked her to elaborate, she said, "Well, when he comes home from school, he goes to his room. He usually finishes the homework in 20 minutes, and then he sits and reads till dinner time." "So why do you think he's depressed?" I asked. She looked at me like I was mad. But that's not David, she said. He's usually running around the house, teasing the dog, accidentally knocking over lamps. I've never seen him sit and read for more than 30 seconds. So I turned to David, who was sitting next to his mother, playing a video game on her phone. David, what books have you read recently? He looked up. Oh, yesterday I finished reading Harry Potter. He's this kid that goes to school to learn to be a wizard, and he plays Quidditch by flying around on his broomstick, and he fights off bad spirits, and he has lots of friends. Have you read Harry Potter? And I responded, I have, and I think I loved it just about as much as you do. He smiled and went back to his video game. I turned back to his mother. If David had been born to act like he does when he's on medication, if he had been born with a tendency to sit and enjoy reading for hours, would you have been concerned? Well, no, of course not. So David is not depressed. This is the David that he would have been had he not been born with ADHD. Now that he is on medication, he is better able to express himself. He is better able to communicate to what he is thinking and feeling. So medication is not depressing him, but simply allowing him to be himself.
Wow.
So let me stop there and just ask you for your input about those three stories.
I'm taken aback and I'm really appreciating that, on the podcast and in my coaching practice, we really think about perspective and how you get to see the circumstance depending on where what you want to take from it. And so as you're describing, the zombie concerns, but also maybe it's the perspective of, hey, this is what your kid can be like when they can access some of those like self-regulation tools in their brain. It's not necessarily a zombie, just sort of like massaging a perspective is a really powerful tool for thinking about medication and your child's changes. And so my brain's spinning. I feel like inspired and kind of like my thoughts are popcorning around. So tell me more kind of how parents can utilize these different perspectives as a way to explore medication.
Well, I think the important thing is to remember that there are really three different kinds of side effects to medication. The first side effect is dose related. And basically what that means is the more medication you take, the more side effect you get. So for instance, if a child has takes medication after dinner, and it's still active in his system, he's going to have trouble falling asleep. If you increase the dose, he's going to have even more trouble falling asleep. So that's a dose-related question. The second is time-related. That's the problem that we saw with Danny at the bus stop, that his medication was wearing off. And the third is what's called an idiosyncratic side effect. And that means that some people get it and some people don't. And it depends on your genetics or your personality or other characteristics. But the important thing here is to understand if you have a concern about a side effect and your child's on medication, you need to communicate that to your doctor. But if you communicate it with an understanding of those three different kind of side effects, I think you can clearly get your doctor to understand what the problem is, that it always occurs at 3:30. On the weekends, it occurs at 4:30 or 5:30, but he also gets up at 10:30 in the morning instead of 7:30. So knowing the time of day that a side effect is occurring, knowing how it increases or decreases over time, can help the physician be a better physician and prescribe medication in a way that is more specific to that individual child.
I love it. And that's kind of like how we do when we're changing or examining any sort of behavior in terms of we're looking for patterns, right? We're looking for
Exactly.
what precedes it, maybe what time, what reactions happen that might either reinforce or sort of confound the situation. So it's really interesting that you can take that mental toolbox and apply it to finding the right medication.
Exactly. You put that very well.
Well, thanks. I love this stuff. It's really, really interesting. So another thing that parents describe in the finding the right medication journey is, how do I explain medication to kids? You know, and you and I know that they work on brain chemicals, and there's like a couple different types, and you described that there's the short acting versus long acting, the gradual release. Do you have ways that you recommend parents explore medication, like kind of the verbiage and what they do in kids' brains?
Well, I do, but I don't want to get too technical here. But I'll give it a try. Let me first ask you, how many do you use Facebook at all?
Not a ton, but I have a Facebook like
How
for the podcast.
how many friends do you have?
In my personal Facebook, like 1,100.
I want you to imagine. And also, let me ask you a second question. How many people are on the face of the earth right now? How many people?
Ooh.
What's the population of the world?
That is an excellent question. I think it's like 7 billion, but don't
Ex
quote me.
exactly, 7.5 billion.
Oh.
So, okay, I want you to imagine a situation where there are 14 Earths. Every one of those Earths has 100,000. I'm sorry, every one of those Earths has 7 billion people on it. Okay. And every one of those 7 billion people on the 14 different Earths all have 10,000 Facebook friends. Okay. I want to now ask you, what would happen if all 100 billion of those people with their 10,000 Facebook friends sent a message to all their 10,000 Facebook friends all at the same time? What would happen?
We would crash Facebook,
You absolutely would. And that's what happens in the brain of a child every second. What those numbers mean is there's 100 billion nerve cells in the developing child's brain. 100 billion nerve cells. And every one of those nerve cells connects with 10,000 other nerve cells. And at the point of the connection, there is a release of a chemical called a neurotransmitter. And when that neurotransmitter crosses that space and connects with the other neuron or the other nerve cell, it communicates with that nerve cell. It sends a message. And that's how the brain communicates with itself, and that's how the brain works. However, there's one problem with that, with what I just described. If those chemicals are connecting at the other end of the nerve cell, once they get connected, then it seems like the brain would shut down. The brain couldn't communicate any longer because that messenger, that neurotransmitter, is sitting on the receiving nerve ending, and it's kind of blocked now, blocked the entryway of any more neurotransmitters, and it can't communicate any longer. So the brain's developed a tool called neurotransmitter transporters. These proteins take the chemical from the sending neuron off the surface of the receiving neuron, injects it back into the sending neuron, which then allows it to send another message a few milliseconds later.
Okay, so it's
Okay.
kind of like somebody walking into a doorway, and instead of standing like a starfish and blocking the doorway, there's somebody that's like, hey, walk in this side door so the main door's open.
Great example. Another
Okay.
example would be that the medication acts like a key that unlocks the door. But if you leave the key in there and on the other side and close the door, then nobody else can get in.
Right. Okay. So
So
medication
what
helps.
medication does, medication's an imposter. What I mean by that is that it has almost the same chemical structure as the neurotransmitters in the brain that are sending the messages. But what it does is it connects with that transmitter protein and fills up the space that the neurotransmitter would have filled up. So instead, that causes the neurotransmitter to be in a higher concentration in that space, and therefore more likely to be able to communicate messages. So what's happening in the brain of a child with ADHD is that certain areas of the brain aren't as active as they are in other children. And when they take the medication causes those chemicals to act in such a way that the brain is now just as active as it is in children who don't have ADHD. So what the medication's actually doing is for a few hours is actually changing the way the brain functions so that it functions just like it does in everybody else. Now, most parents would see that as an advantage. Some parents might see that as a disadvantage if they really like their child's personality when he was on medication, but usually that's not the case. And so what medication does, it not only changes the child's ability to focus and concentrate and to learn, but it also allows that child to be open to social cues, to messages received from other friends and students, so that he or she can behave appropriately, form good friendships, and be happy with his or her life.
Right. And that's kind of how I usually structure the medication conversation. If people are like, oh, I don't really know, like, how do I talk to my kid about this? It's kind of like meds have the chance to give you the opportunity, like the brain space, to learn skills and strategies and kind of open up that window for you so that you're more effectively and efficiently gaining skills like executive function strategies
Exactly, right.
without kind of like fighting against your neurochemistry. And while you pointed out something that I really want to like give an attention spotlight to for listeners, and that's as you think about these 10 Earths and then the 10,000 Facebook friends and just kind of understanding this analogy, I also want you to realize how depersonalized this can feel in a good way. Because if you're thinking about the brain through an analogy or brain chemistry, it gives you the chance to realize that all of these things that your kid struggles with, the executive dysfunction, if you know you're coming to this podcast with maybe a kid that doesn't have ADHD technically but has some of the symptoms, stick with it because it's the same idea. It's not a moral failing. It's not a character flaw. It is a chemical difference in their brain. And that perspective alone switches you into detective perspective, like we talk about on the show, because you get the chance to think about, what would help in this situation rather than being upset by the manifestations of the brain differences. So rather than being like, oh, this behavior is driving me crazy, instead you're thinking like, I wonder what's causing this, and I wonder what we can do about it, and I wonder what skills he or she needs. It really just changes the whole flavor of and moves it into problem solving.
Exactly right. I one time had a child who his mother brought in a letter that he had written to his teacher the day before and handed it to me, and I read it, and it turns out that this child had told his he got angry with his teacher and told her to shut up. Okay. And on his own, he wrote a letter to his teacher apologizing for that. Nobody asked him to do it. Nobody told him he had to do it. But he wrote this letter, and in the letter he said, "Dear Mrs. Miller, I'm so sorry that I told you to shut up yesterday. I know that I shouldn't have, and I know that was a bad kid yesterday. But if you give me another chance, I can be the best kid in your class." And he said, "Oh," and then he finished by saying, "Sometimes my brain just blurts out things that I don't seem to have any control over, and I'm sorry for doing that." He actually, without knowing it, he understood exactly what was happening with his ADHD. It was creating impulsivity, which caused him to do first and think later, as opposed to think first and then do. And that got him into trouble. And
Sure.
it, any rate, I hope that exemplifies exactly what you were talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it just, kind of extending that depersonalization, what you described was sometimes my brain does this, sort of giving kids the chance to talk about their brain versus them, the human, is also really powerful because then you're in problem solving mode for yourself, recognizing that yes, I do actions, but they're driven by my brain, and there's a little bit of a sort of a lifting of some of the emotional components where it's still your responsibility, but it's not your fault. And you get the chance to kind of play in that gray space of, okay, how do I own this without being furious with myself because I didn't choose the brain I have.
That's an excellent point, and I agree completely.
Yeah. So, as we kind of close out, and we definitely encourage people to get your book and read it and talk about it with other people. I mean, really give yourself the chance to digest this. For parents and listeners who are kind of like, oh, I don't know, what do you say to them to kind of move them on their journey?
Well, I think the first place I is that I one time saw a sign outside of a bank that said, "The more you believe, the less you know." And basically, what it meant was once you form preconceived notions, it kind of shuts out your ability to approach something logically.
Yeah.
You get wedded to a thought or an idea. And all I would ask parents to do is to open their minds to the possibility that medication may be a helpful adjunct. Medication will not teach a child to do anything. We still need teachers. We still need executive function trainers and counselors. We still need tutors. We still need to teach children. But now, suddenly, they're open to it. Just like the 12-year-old girl that became the 19-year-old girl, her grades changed almost overnight. And it's not because the medication did anything magical. It just let her be the person that she was meant to be. And
Right.
if you don't experience that, and suddenly your child is 26 and having difficulties keeping a job, it's a little late at that point to intervene. You can still intervene, and medication will still be helpful at 26, but that person will not have learned what he ex was expected to learn from the years of 10 through 26. And so medication can be helpful for adults as well, extremely helpful. It can be the difference between keeping a job and losing a job, or keeping a marriage and losing a marriage. I one time went to a party, and a mother asked me what I do, and I told her, and she said, "Oh, my son's getting married next week. His wife told him that if he didn't keep taking his ADHD medication, though, she wouldn't marry him."
Wow. That must
Yeah,
make a big difference in his brain.
because basically he was a different person on medication, and he wasn't as cooperative or attentive to her needs as he was when he was on the medication as well. So that was 5 or 6 years ago. They're still happily married.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I love hearing your experience and your perspective as well. It's really been helpful for me to just kind of like get into that mental jungle gym and think about things in different ways. So I encourage listeners as well to kind of dive in, explore it and
Exactly. And I would ask them not to be afraid by the technical parts of ADHD. I've tried in the book to make things as non-technical as possible without compromising on the amount of information that I want the parents to be able to gain from this. So I think that I've been able to communicate some complex ideas and distill them into a way that is easy to understand and maybe even fun to read as well.
Right. And we can use strategies for it, like take it in chunks or reread if
Exactly.
you need to or interact with the text. I mean, like you can write in your book, right? Unless you got it from the library.
Exactly right.
Okay, well, before we go, I had a question that you're the right person to ask. Some of the struggle with medication is that you gotta try a few. And in trying a few, there's like a period of time that you have to give them to really assess their efficacy. About how many medications on average do you see people trying before they're like, Cinderella, or I'm sorry, Goldilocks, I got the right mix. This works for me.
Well, let me first ask you a question before I answer that. How many medications do you think there are available and approved by the FDA for the treatment of ADHD? How many would you guess?
I know there's stimulant, non-stimulant category, and then within those, I'd say probably like 10 to 15 each, maybe 30.
Try 46.
Okay.
There's 46 medications used for the treatment of ADHD. 36 of them are stimulant medications, and those are the ones that are almost identical, that act as imposters in the brain. Those 36 medications represent only two different chemical substances: methylphenidate, which is the main ingredient in Ritalin, Concerta, Daytrona, and many other medications, but it's all the same chemical substance, and amphetamine, which you can find in Adderall and Vyvanse, and again, many other, Excedrin and many other medications as well. But there's really only, of those 36 medications, there's really only two chemical substances. And the difference is that every one of those different brand name medications do something completely different. So one is a liquid. So if a child has trouble swallowing a pill, he can take a liquid. Another one's an orally dissolving pill or a chewable tablet. Another one comes in a skin patch, which can last up to 3 or 4 hours if you take the patch off early, or it can last 15 to 16 hours if you leave the patch on. Some of those medications last 4 hours, some last 6 hours, some last 14 hours, some last 24 hours. And so having all of these medications available gives you the possibility of tailoring specific treatment for a specific child. And I think that's the goal. I think that all physicians would share that goal, but they may not know about all 36 medications. And matter of fact, I didn't even know about three of those medications when I started writing the book. So there's a lot that the physicians need to know. And I'm not saying that it's the parent's job to go to the physician and say, why not this medication? But it is the parent's job to say, the medication seems to be wearing off too soon and he gets really irritable when it wears off. Is there something we can do about that?
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. With that of the 46 combos, my experience has been trying like four to six before they find like the right mix. Is that around about the same for you?
I think it's really variable from person to person. There's some kids that start on a medication and from day one it works well. They don't have side effects. 2 years later they may need an increase in dose, but of course they now have increased their weight by 15 pounds and they need an increased dose simply because they weigh more and there's a bigger body absorbing that medication. And they coast through life without any difficulties. That's not true of maybe 60% of children. 60% of children will have some difficulty finding the right dose or the right medication. But I think the important thing is to focus on, when you say a response to medication, distinguish between the good response and the bad response, and then try to find a new way of administering that medication, or a new timing, or a different medication that gives you the same or greater benefit with less side effects. And actually, I spent about 40 pages in the book talking about each individual side effect and how to manage them so that they're not a major problem. So the main side effects are difficulty falling asleep, decreased appetite, irritability, mood suppression, increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. And in the book, we talk about every one of those side effects and what to do with either medication or without medication, change those side effects so that they're no longer a problem.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean,
So
it's something that.
the answer to the question, it does it work and is it safe, is yes and yes.
And just like with everything in life, you might have to strategize a little bit, right?
Might have to work to get that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But all I can say is we're not talking about an antibiotic that's going to be used for 10 days. We're talking about a medication that may be used for the next 5, 10, 20, or even 50 years of that person's life. And as a result, it behooves us to get it right early on.
And test run it and be open to know that like it is a process, it's gonna take time, all that stuff. Yeah.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
And to be
Man.
able to a ask the questions of your doctor, not just sit there like the mother did, thinking her child was depressed, but ask the question so that your doctor understands where you're coming from and maybe can clarify what you're actually seeing as a side effect or as a treatment for that side effect.
Right. And you know, like use your own executive function tools, right? Like take notes, whatever it is that you need to do to sort of systematize the experimentation, it's absolutely fine. It's really helpful to come to your doctor with data
Exactly.
and patterns and all that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, cool. I'm hoping that listeners are able to get your book, really chew on it, and just have this be part of their experience in supporting executive function development.
I would agree completely with that. That's a great way to end the
Hey, it's like I've done this before.
podcast
Well,
on.
thank you so much for your time and your expertise. This has been a really good brain shakeup for me. And I imagine listeners are going to feel the same way.
I hope so. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Executive Function Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please head over to sarahcasti.com, where you'll find more resources and chances to connect with others. And please remember to like and review the show wherever you listen to this podcast. We're eager to transform the lives of even more families.